This interview was originally part of the Jodcast. For the full show, please visit www.jodcast.net. Quasars, or quasi-stellar radio sources, were discovered in the 1950s using radio telescopes. In the decades that followed, astronomers discovered that quasars lie at vast distances from us and produce huge amounts of energy. What are these mysterious things called quasars?
We think, or most astronomers think, that quasars are black holes which are accreting or gobbling up some material, principally probably dust and gas and things like that, but maybe the odd star or two.
Steve Rawlings, Professor of Astronomy at Oxford University.
So when they do this, they, although as is well known, black holes have a great difficulty actually radiating, which is why they're called black holes.
Yes.
While they're doing that, the stuff that's being gobbled up tends to get heated up and gives rise to all sorts of crazy emission.
How does it get heated up?
Again, this is a subject that people spend whole careers studying, but crudely there's some sort of thing called an accretion disk, which is basically just a flat rotating reservoir of material that's actually being gobbled up by a black hole. And it's essentially the interactions between clumps of material in that rotating disk that actually causes the heating up and the eventually the light to come from the disk.
We're essentially detecting these black holes through the emission, the light coming from this accretion disk.
Well,
around it.
In fact, what I'm talking about today goes one step further. So there's this thing that we call reprocessing. So the light in the disk, light is generated in the disk, and light can be generated right down to quite close to the black hole. But that light has a tough time getting out. And it often interacts with other things on the way, and we call this reprocessing. So what I'm talking about today is really finding quasars by a method which looks at dust heated by the light from the disk, but at a much larger radius than the disk itself.
Okay, how, one step back, how does the light interact with the stuff in the accretion disk? What are the actual physical processes which the light goes through on its way out?
The light has to be emitted in some form. So this is either, the astronomers basically put things down into two categories. One's called continuum radiation and one's called line radiation. So line radiation is radiation that's emitted at very specific frequencies or wavelengths. And that tends to come from actually processes within atoms or molecules when you learn physics, particularly at university, you learn about quantum mechanics and energy levels and all these fancy things. Basically, one of the natural things that comes out of that is you tend to get these very sharp features which are called line radiation. And then there are sources of radiation which go over much larger wavelengths and frequencies, and we call this continuum radiation. And that can be radiated by lots and lots of complicated physical processes, but often they're as simple as charged particles interacting with each other, and typically the lighter particle being accelerated away by the interaction, and that is the cause of the radiation.
So they're all quasars. When we look at the light coming from these quasars, they look like this. They have a sort of a broad continuum emission and a series of spikes. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically how quasars were discovered as well. Now, what we found over recent years is that there are whole classes of quasars which apparently have big gaps in that broad spectrum, i.e. they're, if you look optically, you can't see them at all.
Right.
And that's thought to be due to something as simple as dust obscuration. So as sort of one of the first things you learn in astronomy is we find it very hard optically to see the centre of our own galaxy because there's lots of dust in the way, and dust absorbs light. And the same seems to be true of most quasars, and that's in fact what I'm talking about today. So although intrinsically, if you could see all the light coming out from the quasar, you would find it would be roughly equally spread across the whole electromagnetic spectrum.
Right.
This reprocessing, in this case by dust, just blocks out the optical, and so these things are essentially invisible in the optical. So the way we found things that we can't see is we used initially a combination of radio observations, which radio waves don't get absorbed by dust, And that's one of the great things about radio astronomy. We've used that in combination with a far infrared measurement. And far infrared radiation is actually the emission from dust.
Right.
Rather than, and in fact, that's where the energy that's absorbed optically actually reappears in the infrared.
So the far infrared observations show you where the dust is.
We've combined these two methods, which basically either are immune to dust in the case of radio, or actually tell you about dust in the way of infrared. And that's been made possible by a satellite called Spitzer in the infrared, and the big new radio surveys, which of course Jodrell Bank is playing a very active part in.
Where is this dust? In the picture that we've got a bright emitting disk of some sort around a black hole. We call that a quasar, but where's the dust?
Well, the dust is actually at much larger radii, so typically the sort of light from the central region is coming from light years, light months, that sort of scale from the centre. Now, out at thousands of light years from the centre, we believe there's regions where stars are forming, and this is called a fancy word, but it's called a circumnuclear star formation region, which is, you know, a thousand times further out than the actual disk itself.
Right.
But those sort of regions where stars form are always rich in dust, and that's one place in which we're pretty certain we're seeing dust from. But in fact, the evidence we see tends to suggest the dust is coming from a whole range of distances from the centre. Some fairly cool dust out at these very large radii, but also dust that's so close to the nucleus that it's only just avoiding being melted.
Right.
Okay. Now, you can't see dust very, very close in, because the radiation field of the accretion disk is so strong that the dust grains are heated to a high enough temperature that they just melt and disappear.
Right. It ceases to be dust.
Yes.
So how do you know, though, how far away the dust is in this picture that we've drawn from your observations?
Well, it's, as often in astronomy, it's a combination of detailed modelling. So, in fact, it doesn't have to be that detailed. If you make a fairly simple model and you put a radiation field and dust, it's something you could do as an undergraduate project, actually, and you put some dust at some distance from a quasar, it is fairly simple physics to work out what the spectrum, as we call it, what the energy output as a function of wavelength or frequency looks like for a given radius. And very broadly speaking, the further out you are, the cooler the dust, the closer you're in, the hotter the dust. So that's a method that's used very, very commonly. There are other more direct methods trying to look to see if the dust, if the emission from the dust varies in time. And typically it doesn't, which is another indication that it's coming from large scales. Mm. Things that come from very small scales can change very quickly, and so there are a bunch of methods, and often in astronomy, when the first method is tried, you're not sure you believe it, but when you try six different methods and they all give you the same answer, you start to believe it.
It's a conspiracy.
It can always be a conspiracy.
How far away are these quasars from us?
Okay, well, they're a long way. So they're sort of redshifts of... So the objects I'm talking about today are typically at a redshift of 2.
Right.
And the best way to think about that is to think that those quasars were around when the universe was a small fraction of its current age. So we currently believe the universe is 13.6 billion years old.
Right.
And these quasars were around when the universe was a few gigayears old.
Right.
And so talking about how far away they are, you take those times and multiply by the speed of light and you get a very large number.
Yes.
But I tend to prefer to think about, rather than how far away things are, which is important, at what point in the universe, what time in the universe did they emit the light that we received?
So these are so-called cosmological things. They are an awfully long way away.
Yeah, they're a very, very long way away. So we're talking about billions of light years. So that's
what do we learn from the observations of dust from quasar measurements? What do we learn about the dust between us and the quasar?
Well, we learn a whole load of different things. So we found these objects using Spitzer survey data.
Mm-hmm.
We actually were successful in getting Spitzer time to follow these objects up, where we used a spectrometer that split the light, the infrared light, up into features. And in those spectra, we've seen all sorts of features due to particular types of dust. So there's a feature that's only caused by dust that's made up of silicates.
Right.
So it has silicon in it. So we learned that, you know, the silicate out at redshift 2. We weren't the first people to show that, but in fact Spitzer is the first telescope that's had the sensitivity to show that in general.
Right.
And we've also found these things called PAH features, which are polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which is a
well done
a long way round of saying fairly complicated combinations of carbon and hydrogen atoms that many people think are related to the building blocks of life.
Well, that in itself is fascinating, isn't it? The fact that we are able to find these.
Yes.
Are they precursors to life? Are they necessary to produce life as we know it, Jim?
There's a very big debate about that, and I'm not an expert in this field, but I mean, certainly, you know, if you go and look on the web as to the current debate about this, a lot of people who work on this and who are expert on this say, yes, these are essential. These are an essential part of the process that builds up life, but that's a very big question.
We'll leave that alone. How complicated are these PAHs?
Oh, they're very complicated. So, I mean, in fact, I was boning up on this on the way up on the train because I'm not an expert on this, but, you know, when I was at school, I did chemistry, and you have these things like benzene, complicated things that basically are a ring of, let's say, six carbon atoms,
right,
each attached to one hydrogen atom. Mm. And benzene is something that I remember playing around with at school. But basically, these PAHs are molecules like that stuck together, so they're many rings. And in fact, some of the ones that have been discovered in our own galaxy, I believe, have you know, hundreds, thousands of atoms in them. So they can get very complicated. Mm. And that's why people get excited, because obviously there are molecules in human beings that are very large and complicated. There's a large number of steps going from saying we found this to saying this is how you generate life. But it is an interesting thing.
Right. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Cheers.